Today is the last lecture on the course, and the topic is managing employee turnover. So last week we were talking about employee turnover in the aggregate sense. You know, we were talking about measuring employee turnover at the organizational level or at the workplace level. So we were calculating turnover rate, well, quit rate in particular, per month or per year. And much of the last lecture was about the idea that turnover can be both harmful as well as to some extent useful to organizational performance. And we've outlined the costs and benefits of employee turnover. We put them together into a model. And we also reviewed empirical evidence behind the curvilinear, the non-monotonic relationship between turnover and performance, finding evidence of it in some cases, which we could explain. So it is possible that turnover is totally negative for organizational performance. This means this happens in situations when costs of turnover are so high that whatever benefits there are cannot be justified as an argument to allow any level of turnover in the optimum. What we didn't do last lecture, and what we're going to do today, is we're going to try to go inside the aggregate figures and try to understand the mechanisms and counter mechanisms that shape the aggregate turnover statistics that we took as given last lecture. So last lecture we didn't really care about the mechanics, we didn't really care about what causes turnover rate of 5% or turnover rate of 25%. We just said, okay, here's turnover rate 5%, turnover rate 50%, anything in between, let's try to find the optimum rate of turnover if it exists. Hey, it can exist under some circumstances. End of the lecture. So today we're going to sort of endogenize turnover and look at what happens at the forces that shape employee intentions to quit and the resulting turnover statistics. We will also look in the remainder of the lecture into certain management practices, not all the instrumentarium of management practices that we can think about in connection with turnover, but some of the most frequently used management practices to manage turnover, to sort of keep turnover at the level that people are comfortable with, organizations are comfortable with, and keep, more importantly, keep the structure of turnover in terms of the nomenclature of workers who are leaving to the optimal structure that the firm would like to have. So we are not only worried about the aggregate level of turnover, we're also worried about who is leaving and who is replacing the leavers. Now, what causes turnover? Now, the heyday of the causes of turnover literature was about 20 years ago. Right now, there aren't really a lot of studies that look at the determinants of turnover, and various reasons. I think this literature will come back to its former glory now that you have much better data than 20 years ago. You can look at turnover at really individual microscopic level. But another reason is that basically there are so many things that cause employee turnover that many management scholars just throw their hands up in the air saying, look, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons. And what's even worse is that the factors behind turnover, they change from study to study. So basically every attempt at meta-analysis, every attempt at summarizing the literature, comes up with a variety of findings which don't really fit very easily into any single paradigm. Having said that, here's what we sort of know. Here's what we think we know. That turnover is affected by personal characteristics, and it's affected by internal environment of the organization, and it's affected also by the external environment of the organization, namely the availability of alternative employment. Now, some of the large range of factors that the literature mentions in connection with factors causing turnover are sort of quite intuitive and almost self-explanatory. Think about external factors, for example, external environment, wage differences between current organization and outside market, right? You know, it doesn't take a PhD in economics to work out that this could be a reason, you know? If you pay €5 an hour and the firm next door is paying €15 an hour, guess what? This will be a major determinant of turnover in the firm that pays €5 an hour. Now, availability of jobs. This is sort of, it's not only the wages that are important, but also whether there are jobs available in the firm that pays €15 an hour. That's obviously also a factor affecting turnover. And that's where we see the most sound and consistent evidence. These are the leading determinants of people's intentions to quit, and the people's intentions to quit, basically the answer to the question, are you thinking about maybe leaving the organization? That's the intention to quit. So the employee hasn't really left yet, but thinking about, and these are the factors that determine in a major way the people's intentions to quit. Now, looking into the factors that happen inside the organization and on the interface between organization and the individual, the story is more interesting and more blurry as well. So look at the individual attitudes to the firm, to the organization where people are working. So here is the two classical HR metrics, organizational behavior metrics, job satisfaction, which is basically some sort of average of the answers to the questions. How well are you? How are you satisfied? How much are you satisfied with various aspects of your job, namely the environment, the colleagues, the pay, the development opportunities, etc. So job satisfaction is found to be significantly correlated with employees' intentions to quit. Commitment. Commitment and turnover intentions are sort of almost endogenous to each other, right? So commitment is basically, what is commitment? Commitment is your answer to the question, how committed are you to the organization? How much do you feel yourself being a member of the organization? How much do you, how loyal are you to the firm where you're working, right? And if you are thinking about maybe leaving the organization, you are almost by definition not very loyal to the organization. So the correlation between commitment and turnover is sort of, it's almost at the logical level, right? And yet there are some literatures, there are some data, even the data that I work with, that really doesn't find very strong correlation between either job satisfaction or commitment to organization, which suggests not necessarily that these factors don't matter. I mean, at some logical level, they should matter. But the way we measure things, the way we measure satisfaction and commitment are just not very, very good, very precise ways of measuring these things. So the picture becomes a lot more nuanced than availability of jobs and employment opportunities outside. Now, let's look at the internal environment of the organization. That's actually where most of the interesting stuff is going to happen. Why? Because the internal environment of the organization is more amenable to management practices. It's the internal environment of the organization that management practices are most likely to affect, right? So employee attitudes such as satisfaction and commitments, yeah, they maybe could be affected to some extent, but we really, you know, they also have to do with personality. Personality, by the way, is also a significant determinant of turnover, and personality is very, very hard to affect, if not impossible to affect. So let's look at the internal environment, factors related to the internal environment that cause employee turnover. And these are stress caused by work pressure or bad psychological climate, basically the more stressful environments. People are trying to There is a term in the psychology literature called coping behavior, and withdrawal and eventual quit is one of the most frequently occurring forms of coping behavior with stress, lack of attention from colleagues, and importantly, line manager. Much more about interactions between employees and line managers and their role in influencing employee turnover later on in the lecture. Performance on the job. especially when you are performance on the job. If you don't fit the performance standards, you're more likely to quit. The relationship though seems to be not monotonic, right? So if you don't fit the standards, you're more likely to quit because they will try to get rid of you, right? They will create conditions for you to leave. Now, if your performance is well above the standard, right? Then you are an excellent worker and you will have a lot of outside opportunities. So this might affect your turnover intentions over and above your fitting performance standards in the workplace. In fact, several years ago, I had a master student in Tilburg University who worked with highly valuable data, actually, from one of the very large Dutch organizations, which I can't really give you the name of. So she found precisely this. She found an inverted U relationship between turnover and the performance grade of employees of the same rank. So basically, employees with low grade were more likely to quit than employees with satisfactory average grade, and employees with high grade were also slightly more likely to quit than the employees with average grade. So it's a U-shaped relationship. But yes, performance on the job does cause turnover. Job worker organization fit. Yeah, so we were talking about bad matches last lecture. This is sort of another way of calling bad match. So it's you can think of job worker organization fit in connection to performance on the job. If the worker does not perform well, then obviously the job worker fit is not perfect. But you can also think about the dimensions of fit other than employee performance, for instance, organizational culture, the way work is organized. You know, you can think of organizations where the work is very, where employees are very heavily monitored, where employees are having to abide by lots of regulations and bylaws. You have to be in the office at 8 o'clock, you have to leave by 7 o'clock. If you don't, then there are sanctions. So you can think about very high sort of control micromanagement environments. You can think of more relaxed environments, and different people find different environments more satisfactory to them, and that's irrespective of their performance. Now, better fit, less likelihood of quitting. Now, so here's a sort of bird's eye view on the factors that affect employee turnover. But to get back to the earlier observation that I made, the empirical evidence is not really consistent from study to study. So at the end of the day, it's likely to be that what causes turnover is not just the sum of the various factors that I've explained, it's rather the combination of this factor, which is very likely to be context-specific and even organization-specific. Having said that, the most powerful, the most uniformly validated predictor of quit is the intention to quit, right? Is the intention to quit. You ask people, do you think about leaving the organization? You collect the responses, yes, no, or to what extent? And this measure is very strongly, this is the highest correlation coefficient in the turnover literature. This is the most powerful predictor of the actual turnover, the intention to quit, right? But of course, a more interesting question is what causes the intention to quit, and there we are lacking very strong evidence. So there's still a lot to learn about why turnover happens. Now, this does not preclude us from thinking about what we can do, what levers firms pull to manage their employee turnover, right? So yes, we don't have very strong empirical evidence. not because we can't measure things very well or because there's a combination of factors, but we can still think about, you know, some local effects that managers can create in order to try and manage employee turnover in their organization. So what does the theory say? Well, what practices firms can do? Well, one of the most frequently discussed practices in HR and personnel management textbooks is a practice of screening job applicants for relevant psychological characteristics, right? So there is a link between psychological characteristics such as big five personality traits, such as attitude to risk, such as attitude to teamwork, basically attitudes to the sort of environment, organizational environment that that employees likely to encounter, and the employees' likelihood of quitting. So if you want to manage employee turnover, if you want, for instance, to have lower turnover, you may want to add a few questions into your screening questionnaire at the time of employing people to, you know, try and select people who you think or who the theory thinks will be less likely to quit in the future. Now, of course, firms do it. But when it really where things become really interesting is a question which is beyond this course, by the way. So speak to your, you know, lawyers who you know. The interesting question is the use of information about employee psychological traits, characteristics, is it sort of legal? Can it be used as a factor in deciding who to hire? Right, so this practice may be perceived as discriminatory. It's very, very gray area. I am not aware of any empirics, either statistics or some individual cases where people would let me know if you've come across something like this. But I'm not aware of cases when people were preferentially hired or discriminated against based on their psychological characteristics at the time of applying for jobs. So it sort of is a possibility, but firms, I'm not sure how eager firms are to use this possibility to manage their employee turnover. Now, a much more workable solution, right? A much less legally controversial solution is to try and improve job worker organization fit. So think about job worker organization fit as among the factors determining employees' intention to quit and turnover. So how can you improve job worker organization fit? So one way to do this is to, well, as the lecture says, accommodate worker differences and changing life circumstances by providing more flexible working conditions. So here we're not talking about job worker fit in terms of objective performance, in terms of how productive workers are. You know, let's say everybody is adequately productive and whoever is not productive gets fired. So we are stuck with people, we are left with people who are, all of whom are reasonably productive, but there's still some turnover. And why is this turnover happening? Well, because people's circumstances no longer fit very well with what the organization wants of them. Now, one of the ways in which person-job organization fit can be vastly improved is the practice of offering more flexible working conditions, right? So what are the working conditions? Well, some of the working conditions cannot be really changed, but one such working conditions is, for instance, working from home, you know, home office. Dr. Rupieta, who teaches tutorials in this course, is a specialist in home office, in working from home. She I think wrote some research articles on home office, so talk to her if you want to learn more. But here's a very famous study in Quarterly Journal of Economics. This guy is the chief executive officer of the firm called Ctrip, which is China's largest travel booking firm, right? So it's really a major business. And he was at some point a PhD student at Stanford University with Nick Bloom and John Roberts. You know, I think an excellent move between academia and business. So at Ctrip, they ran a very large-scale experiment, big firm, big experiment, by allowing some of the workers, of some of the employees at Ctrip, to choose to work from home rather than come to the office, right? So if you're offering home office, it improves flexibility of working conditions. You can choose whether you want to work from the office, or if you don't feel like, you can choose to work from home. Now, as a result of improving, of increasing flexibility of working conditions, and thereby creating a better job worker organization fit, addressing changing circumstances, different circumstances of workers more precisely, what this achieved is the quit rate is a reduction of quit rate by a half, right? So think about it. I really don't know a lot of practices other than paying super high wages would reduce your quit rate by a half. Of course, if you pay high wages like Henry Ford did in 1913 in what is now a classical example, the quit rate plunged, but you know, that is no longer such huge pay increases relative to competition are very very free, are very very infrequent. It's much more practical and cheaper to offer more flexible working condition, and that results in a massive decrease in quit rate, right? You don't bring it to zero, of course, and maybe you don't have to bring it to zero. But you, if you create flexible working conditions, you achieve a major reduction in the quit rate. Now, speaking of wages, attractive wages is, of course, the practice that is most obvious, because outside employment opportunities is the major factor affecting turnover. Right? There's no rocket science about it. You have high turnover, you have to look at the wages that you're paying and compare these wages to the wages of your competitors. Chances are that wages that you're paying adjusted for the working conditions are not as high as those of your competitors, so you may want to think about either increasing real wages by improving working conditions, which is what these guys did, or increasing nominal wages, leaving the working conditions the same, which is what Henry Ford did. And that works. That works, but of course the costs of doing so are potentially very, very high. Now, one interesting practice which goes under the heading setting attractive wages is the practice of making counter offers. So what is the practice of counter offers? Counter offers is about increasing wages or improving working conditions to the workers who are most likely to leave. So it's not a blanket solution. It's not that everybody's wage goes up. It's the wages of particular workers, wages and working conditions of particular workers who are at this point most likely to leave and whom you don't want to lose. Right? That's what's called counteroffer. Let me give you an example. Let me give you an example from the German academia. In German academia, a lot of professors are on the job market all the time. So we had a macroeconomics professor at Konstanz who was on the market and who got an offer from Goethe University Frankfurt. I used to work at Goethe University Frankfurt. It's a great place, so I'm really happy for him. Not that Konstanz is not a great place. That's why I'm here. But he brought in the offer from Frankfurt, and you bring in the offer, and one of the procedures in German academia, which is sort of almost statutory, is the procedure called Verbleibsverhandlungen. Have you heard about it? So these are the negotiations for staying, Verbleibsverhandlungen, right? So, and basically it's about meeting between the employee who got an external offer and the boss of the firm in order to try and understand what the firm can do in order to keep the worker. And these negotiations can be successful, in which case the worker gets an improvement in their working conditions, either in the form of higher wage or maybe more flexible working arrangements, or these negotiations may result in a negative outcome, in which case, well, negative depending on perspective, in which case the turnover occurs. So here's the difference: setting attractive wages to all versus setting attractive wages to the workers who are more likely to quit. And the counter offers is actually it's a good practice in the sense that it's more flexible, right? It's not a blanket solution. You don't pay higher wages to people who are never going to leave. You pay higher wages to people who maybe highly likely will leave, and people who you don't want to lose, right? So if there is an employee who you want to get rid of, brings an external offer, you'd say congratulations and all the best in your new firm. Even if you have to, by law, go through some sort of Verbleibsverhandlungen, which I'm not sure you have to, but even if you do, your Verbleibsverhandlungen will be very easy. You as a boss will say, Nick, I'm happy for the offer that you brought in. My wage offer and other working conditions offer will remain the same. As you know them, take it or leave it. Of course, Nick will not take it, and then you say cheerio and you part your ways. So that's that. This is really, there are many dimensions of flexibilities, many dimensions of flexibility that counter offers offer. Now, but there are some issues with counter offers. That's why counter offers are very selective. It's a very selective practice. So it has advantages and disadvantages, and only in very specific cases do the advantages of counteroffer counter the disadvantages of counteroffers. So yes, you offer high wage to people who bring in external offers, that's why they stay, and you manage your turnover to remain acceptable. But the externality that counteroffers are likely to produce, and this is not really great news, the externality is that, you know, first of all, the other workers who have come to know about counteroffers, and such information is spread within the organization, don't worry about it. You know, all these privacy concerns are there, of course, but people know about these things. So if you have made a counter offer to someone, right, then you think to yourself, why don't I go to the market, get an external offer, bring it in, and maybe I will also get a counter offer. So really, if you're not careful, you're likely to end up in a situation in which the flexibility of counter offers is not there anymore, because everybody brings in external offer and you match these external offers, you engage yourself in the Verbleibsverhandlungen with everybody. That's why in many organizations there are practices that regulate the use of counter offers. In the University of Constance, for example, the Verbleibsverhandlung can only take place with employees who have worked in the University of Constance for at least 3 years. So I worked in the University of Constance since October 2016, so it's just over a year. If I bring an external offer, then according to the internal regulations, they will just automatically tell me, we're happy for you, goodbye, right? So this is to prevent excessive use of counter offers that will really benefit the workers more than the firm. So, if you do decide to make a counter offer, this is still not great news for you. Yes, you have retained the worker who you want to have, but the value of the worker to you, the value of this specific job worker organization match, has obviously gone down by the amount of extra resources that you have had to offer to retain this worker. Remember, in perfectly competitive environment, in the long run, the worker's wage is equal to the worker's marginal product of labor. So basically, the firm's economic profits in the long run in a very competitive market approach zero, right? And so the practice of counteroffers can be thought of as one of the mechanisms of bringing the outcome to its predicted equilibrium level. Now, so Now, I mentioned that counteroffers have to be used very selectively, and there are factors affecting the likelihood of counteroffers. So for, in some cases, counteroffers are more likely to be made. In other cases, counteroffers are less likely to be made. So counteroffers are more likely to be made to employees having to better employees, surprise, surprise, because their value to the firm is higher. Now, counter offers are more likely to be made to workers with more firm-specific human capital, longer tenure in a firm, so hence the regulation in the University of Constance to make counter offers only to people with 3+ years of experience. Now, the reason I mentioned in connection with this regulation is to prevent, you know, excessive use of counteroffer. But here's another reason. Another reason has to do with the fact that workers with longer tenure are likely to be workers with more firm-specific human capital, and these workers, recall the human capital, the human capital lecture of this course. These workers are harder to replace. Right, harder to replace because their replacements will have to be trained in firm-specific skills, which is costly. And firms take these costs into account in deciding whether to make a counteroffer to these workers or not. So two reasons behind, you know, making counteroffers to longer tenured people and, you know, less so to short tenured people. First is to prevent, you know, everybody always being on the market all the time. Rather than doing work, and second reason is that workers with longer tenure are likely to be workers with more firm-specific human capital, which workers are harder, more expensive to replace. So it makes more sense to retain them by offering them a bit more wages. Now, which factors negatively affect the likelihood of a counteroffer? Basically, in what situations are you less likely to make counteroffer? Now, So large firm size, and more co-workers in the same position is basically these things speak about this unwanted externality that counteroffers produce, right? If you make a counteroffer to one employee, then the other employees in the organization will also want to try their luck, and you will end up paying lots of money making counteroffers to all these guys. And the more co-workers in the same position there are, the larger the organization is, the more exposed you are as an organization to workers bringing external offers asking you to match them. Right. So basically, counteroffers are more likely to happen in smaller firms and are more likely to be given to more unique workers, to workers who are relatively few in the organization. Now, another interesting factor that negatively affects the likelihood of counteroffer is a longer labor market experience. So there's a difference between tenure and experience, which I'm sure everybody understands, but just for the record, tenure is the number of, is the amount of time that you stayed in a particular firm. So in my case, my tenure at the University of Constance is 1 year and, November, December, January, February, 1 year and 4 months. Right. So that's my tenure. Now, experience is the amount of time that you spent doing a certain job in whatever organization. So I graduated in 2007. My experience is therefore nearly 11 years, right? Now people with longer tenure are more likely to be made a counteroffer. However, all else equal, people with longer labor market experience are less likely to be made a counteroffer. Why? Because, well, as the paper, as the Barenberger and Black's paper says rather poetically, there are fewer diamonds in the rough among more experienced workers whose productivity is more often evaluated by the market. So what the story here is, if you have been on the market for a long time, chances are that you have found a firm, you have found a job, you have found an environment which gives you the best possible fit between yourself, the organization, and the job. What this means? It means that the value of you to your organization is probably, you know, is probably sort of close to zero, right? It's not that you are not valuable; you are valuable, but your value is likely to be very closely matched by the wage and working conditions that you have that you have received for it. So the longer you stay on the market, the longer your experience on the market is, the more likely, I stress likely, statistically, this is to be the case, right? So if somebody who has been in business for 20 years had 20 years time to find the best organization possible for themselves, and for that organization these people are valuable, but their value is likely to be matched by, you know, the conditions that they offer to them. So if somebody with very long labor market experience, I stress not tenure, comes and shows an external offer, then organizations are statistically less likely to make a counter offer to that person, because the value of this person to the organization, net of the wage and other provisions that they give them, is likely to be low. Now, this, of course, statistically is hard to distinguish, but Barenberger and Black managed to make it, and what they find is that given labor market experience, longer tenured people are more likely to be given a counter offer. Now, given the tenure, people with longer labor market experience are less likely to be given a counter offer. So one simple way to make sense of it is to think of two people. Let's call them John and Paul, both of whom have 20 years of experience on the labor market. But John has always worked in the same firm, whereas Paul changed firm every 5 years. So Paul has worked in four firms. Okay? So now they have the same tenure, sorry, they have the same experience, but John has longer tenure. John will be more likely to be given a counter offer than Paul. So if they both bring external offers, then chances are that counter offer will be more likely to be given to John than to Paul, right? So take... Now, of course, things become more interesting when you vary both tenure and experience, but I find these examples harder to give. So basically, the point is that counter offers are practiced, but they are practiced very, very selectively, and the reasons why they are practiced very selectively I've tried to explain in the last minutes or so. Now, to me personally, a more interesting topic in connection to the business of managing employee turnover is what firms can do in order to engage their managers, in order to engage the other human resource that they have, namely the managers, the supervisors, in dealing with employee turnover. So far we've assumed that there is the firm and there is a worker, and the worker creates some value for the firm. The worker and the firm has a certain degree of fit. Depending on these degree of fit, the worker may or may not leave, and depending on this fit, firms may or may not want to prevent this worker from leaving. However, in reality, between the firm and the worker, there's likely to be several layers of hierarchy, right? So between the worker and the boss, there is line manager, there is department manager, there is division manager, etc. So how about using these people? How about using the management pool in the organization? How about engaging managers in dealing with the problem of employee turnover in their workplace? Remember this picture from the last week's lecture? I showed you, these are real data from a retail organization in Eastern Europe, which shows that the average cashier quit rate varies quite dramatically between workplaces, between different supermarkets in the network, right? So why does it happen? The leading explanation so far is that, what is the difference between workplaces? It's, of course, location and stuff, but it's also And to a large extent, it's a difference in managers. Workplaces are managed by different managers. And this hints, this suggests to the possibility that line managers, the workplace managers, can be a powerful force shaping employee turnover. Remember the old saying, people join companies but leave bosses. So they leave bosses, therefore the quality of the boss, the ability of the boss to deal with turnover can be an asset to firms trying to deal with the problem of employee turnover. Now, and here comes the study that we did together with Guido Friebel and Matthias Heinz. It's not published yet. It's in the process. So we did an experiment with nearly 240 supermarkets. And as part of this experiment, we randomly given different stores different treatments. So these are the treatments. The most interesting one is the treatment labeled manage. In the stores which received this treatment, we sent a letter to the store manager asking them to do what they can to reduce employee turnover in the workplace. This is what this letter looks like. I mean, we've had to withdraw some private information from this letter, but this is sort of how it looked like. The letter said, look, we are really having a huge problem with employee turnover. Can you please help us solve this problem? Can you please try to reduce employee turnover in your particular store? These are the results. Again, I don't have time to go through the rest of the treatments that we did. You can study them yourselves. Most interestingly, look here. These are the effects of the manage treatment. These are the effects of the letter sent to store managers asking them to reduce employee turnover in their stores. And, well, these effects are sort of, they are significant not only statistically looking at the stars, but they're also significant economically. Look at the quit rate in the group of stores, the average quit rate in the group of stores that didn't receive any treatment. It was about 7.5%, 8%. Per month, extremely high. Now, in the stores that did receive the letter, the quit rate was somewhat lower, right? So we're talking about maybe a reduction of the quit rate by a quarter or so, yeah? So notice it was only the letter, no incentives, no money, nothing, no bonuses based on turnover statistics. So managers can be effective. What these results show is that line managers can be effective as a tool that organizations can use to deal with employee turnover in them. Right? So forget about wages, forget about working conditions, forget about counteroffers. All these practices are important. But here, none of these practices is taking place. The only thing that changes is whether or not managers are asked to deal with employee turnover or not. And if you can ask managers to deal with employee turnover, then they will deliver. Of course, the effect dies out gradually. It dies out. Why does it die out? Because the letter was sent only once. And, you know, then people forget about it. Then people see that, yes, they are putting in some effort to manage employee turnover, but it's not registering with the top management. They're not getting any bonuses, they're not getting promoted, they're not getting distinguished in any way at all, and so they just get back to their normal, they get back to their old allocation of tasks, and the effect of this treatment on turnover vanishes. So what another interesting observation that these data offer is that yes, managers can be a valuable source in dealing with employee turnover, but you need to couple, if you want to use managers as a tool to deal with employee turnover, you need to also offer some sort of incentives to managers to do so. Because status quo is not sufficient. Now, another interesting question that one may ask looking at the results from our study is the question, okay, we've seen some statistics about the monthly quit rate going down. What happens? What is going on? What do managers do to achieve lower turnover? Now, one cheeky thought that came to our mind when we were looking at the data was, oh, well, one easy way to deal with employee turnover is to not fire people who are clearly shouldn't be there, who clearly shouldn't be there, right? If you look at exit interviews, if you look at, you know, company records, if you look at the company record file that documents the reasons why people quit, there are some cases, not many, but there are some cases when people are actually fired for various transgressions that they committed at their work, such as, for instance, turning up for work while under the influence of alcohol, stealing, bad customer service, etc., systematic absence from the workplace. So these are really, really horrible, bad job worker matches, and everybody would profit from dissolving them. And ironically, these are the cases when employee turnover is very easy to manage. All you have to do is not to fire them, right? The employee turnover is the easiest to manage if it happens not because employee wants it, but because it's you who want it. So the simple way to manage employee turnover is just stop firing people. And that is not necessarily a good practice, right? So fortunately, the share of people who were fired for bad behavior was not affected by our treatment. So managers did not start to fire fewer people for bad work behavior. The proportion remained more or less the same. So this explanation is fortunately not the case. So what do managers do? It turns out that managers achieve lower employee turnover in their stores by spending more time talking to employees. It's that simple, right? So it's not rocket science at all. If you want to reduce employee turnover, you just have to pay attention to your employees, right? Talk to them, advise them, you know, don't be their buddy, not necessarily, you know, you don't have to go for a beer with them all the time, right? But you should not treat your employees as human resource, right? You should treat them as people, you should treat them as persons, and that involves communications, that involves talking, that involves counseling and advice. So that seems to be the reason why we've seen an improvement in employee turnover, a decrease in the quit rate as a result of the managed treatment. Managers spending more time talking with their employees. Okay, so these are the things that firms can do in order to try to manage their employee turnover, in particular to try and reduce their employee turnover, to try and bring it back to more manageable level, right? Not necessarily to zero. But whatever management practice you use, or maybe use a combination of management practices, they will not necessarily work. They will not necessarily reduce turnover to zero, even if you want to reduce turnover to zero. If you want to reduce turnover to zero, you just have to throw lots of money at people. But that's not economically profitable. So let's agree that turnover can't be fully prevented. Now, if turnover can't be fully prevented, so people are leaving despite your counteroffers, despite your talking to them, you know, despite your creating more flexible working conditions for them, such as home office. They say, sorry, it's been great here, but I really need to go. I really decided that I will go and work for another firm. What should you do then? Then we're moving from the practices of reducing quit rate to the practices of managing the existing turnover. The practice of managing the existing turnover and the purpose of these practices, the aim of these practices, is to try to minimize the negative consequences that the employee turnover that you couldn't have managed is likely to have on your performance, on the performance of your organization. So we are talking about ways to reduce the costs of actual turnover that exists and you can't do anything about. Couple of things you can do in this department. Number one, standardize jobs. What is job standardization? Job standardization is about creating job descriptions and protocols and incorporating them in the training of new workers. Have you ever worked in some sort of takeaway, such as some sort of fast food thing, such as McDonald's, Burger King? No? Maybe coffee shops? No? Have you ever worked anywhere? Yeah? So, good. Now, I once worked in a takeaway in Scotland. Horrible, horrible place. There was a protocol. There was a protocol what you should do and in what sequence if you want to make a portion of chips, for instance. Or if you want to fry up something. Right? So, and of course, there was the main reason was the technology and health and safety. But there was another reason that, you know, people had to learn a certain sequence of things, which the management of this takeaway thought was the optimal, was the way to deliver their service. And I know that this is, in the industry, this is a pretty common practice. They basically write down a memo to all the employees, telling them about what they should do in which sequence. More than once, when I was on the tour of supermarkets, more than once I saw, it's not visible to customers, but if you are really inquisitive, you can sort of look inside the cash booth and see a small piece of paper with steps that every cashier has to go through serving each customer. So, number one, say hello. Number two, say, do you have a cash card or any sort of bonus card? Number three, say, thank you. I don't remember. There's a sequence of five or six steps, right? This is, I think, an example, a sort of very good, simple example of standardizing jobs, creating job descriptions and protocols that are on paper, that are meant to convey the standards and basic technology for people to do their jobs as the firm sees it, right? The descriptions and job protocols may differ from organization to organization, in which case it forms part of the firm-specific human capital. Cashiers who leave these places, they also are replaced by people who don't know that they first have to say hello and then they have to say, here's your bill. Cashiers are replaced by people who are not really sure whether they should ask, do you have a cash card or not, right? So people in bakeries are replaced with new workers who don't really know whether they should say Darf es noch was sein or not. So it's these little things, right, that you standardize. Now, if you move to more senior, sort of more complicated jobs, then the standards become more and more complicated. And instead of just a piece of paper with steps, you get a thick booklet with various regulations and bedingungen. I think, right. So all these regulations about how a bachelor thesis should look like. How a PhD thesis should look like, how the defense should look like, what are the rights and responsibilities of staff members and students are at the university. These literature, big books, which nobody reads, of course, that's not true. These exist in order to try to manage the inevitable turnover of people, right? So rather than lose firm-specific human capital, which consists in following a certain well-established procedure, firms try to prevent this loss by putting it down on paper and educating, incorporating these procedures in the training of newly arrived employees. So, thing number two, not all knowledge, not all firm-specific capital you can codify, right? In fact, some people would say, if you can codify certain practice, then it's not firm-specific human capital because it's going to be copied by guys like me looking inside the cashier's booth and then setting up a new firm with the same practices, and then there's competition and the return on this firm-specific human capital is going to go to zero. So not all knowledge can be codified. what can you do to try and prevent the uncodified knowledge, right? There are a couple of things you can do. One is to organize work to be done in teams so that the knowledge is shared by team members and may be retained, even if part of the team leaves, right? So rather than organize the work individually, you organize working in teams. Look at, for instance, how German academia is organized. The core element of the German academic system, the German university system, is the Lehrstuhl, the chair, right? So the chair is headed by the chaired professor. So I'm the chair of organizational economics at the University of Konstanz. But there are also various academische Räte and wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiter and PhD students and other associates. Now, so it's really a team, and a lot of research is done in a team between the chaired professor and a postdoc or a PhD student who is working as an employee at that chair. So that's a sort of prototypical team. This is the team as I know it from inside. And, you know, people criticize the system on many counts, and maybe rightly so, but one thing that's really great about this system is this team and collegial environment in which research is done. And this is the excellent way for junior faculty, junior researchers, to learn how to do research. There's no textbook that teaches you how to do research, really, right? So there's no textbook research for dummies that you can read on the train, right? You have to learn it on the job. And the way to learn it on the job is to work in a team with more experienced people so that the experience would be spread between them. So even if there is turnover, even if some of the team members are leaving, because the work was done in the team, because the knowledge will reside in the team and therefore can be impaired to newly hired employee to replace the quit. Now, this observation leads me to a third point I'd like to make in connection with dealing with consequences of employee turnover, namely about having a knowledge management strategy. Have a knowledge management strategy of collecting and recording the knowledge created by the workers in the form of patents, proposals, ideas, and the like. So many organizations have the so-called knowledge management systems. To be honest, I'm not exactly sure what it is, right? And I am really not sure that many people know what a knowledge management system is. I guess part of the reason is because it's very, very firm specific. But think about it as a database. Think about it as a database, as a sort of cloud storage space where various memos, ideas, and other pieces of firm-specific knowledge are kept for access to all members of the organization. So one example, again from academia, not surprisingly. Recently, we have slightly changed the format and guidelines for writing reports on bachelor thesis. So now there is a form, now there's a new form that every professor who is marking bachelor thesis has to fill in. This was created by one particular professor at our Department of Economics who put it down as a memo. Now, we looked at it, he presented it during the professorium a couple of months ago, and we said, oh, that's cool, that's better than the form that we have right now. If he kept this form to himself, and if we only had some sort of vague knowledge about it, suppose he leaves or retires, right? Then this knowledge would be lost. But we have a sort of prototypical knowledge management strategy, and part of this knowledge management strategy is to ask this professor, can you please circulate this memo to all the chairs in our department so that we can learn from this form and we can use it in our practice? So this knowledge, I mean, of course, in other environments, knowledge management strategies can be more complicated, but I guess this very simple example tells you much about how knowledge management strategy looks in its most obvious prototypical form. And basically, you It's about the way to collect the knowledge within the organization and make it available to its various members so that no knowledge or as little knowledge as possible is lost when people who produce this knowledge leave the firm. Okay, now, this lecture is drawing to a close. It's a short lecture. Let us summarize the points that we've gone through. In the next edition of the course, I've added lots more on the practices of managing employee turnover, namely the various practices of firing people and laying people off, but this material is not going to be taught in this edition of the course. So now let's summarize. This lecture is about managing employee turnover. And we began this lecture by looking at factors that affect employee turnover. The most important factor that affects employee turnover is intention to quit. The intention to quit is most reliably correlated with external employment opportunities. Basically, yeah, as I said, if there's another firm paying higher wage, then guess what? Everybody will try to go there. So there is little you can do about that, but there are practices, a selection of practices that firms can still implement in order to manage their employee turnover, in order to reduce their employee turnover in particular, right? If they have to. And we were talking under this heading, we were talking about creating more flexible working environments, home office practice, and we've seen evidence that this practice works. We were also talking about counteroffers, and we've seen the evidence that counteroffers are practiced selectively by firms, right? So we know that they are practiced by firms, but they're not practiced uniformly. They are only practiced for particular specific groups of employees, which are characterized in terms of their uniqueness to the firm and in terms of the length of the tenure. In terms of the length of their work experience in total, right? So the more unique a worker is to the firm, the more likely this worker is to be given a counteroffer. The less unique this worker is to the firm, the less likely that this worker will be given a counteroffer, right? So the longer the worker works with a particular firm, the more likely it is that he or she will be given a counteroffer. But all else equal, workers with longer total labor market experience are less likely to be given a counteroffer. Now, and the third practice of managing employee turnover that we were talking about during today is the practice of using intermediate managers, the practice of using line managers in order to engage with employees and thereby prevent them from thinking and quitting the organization. So we've seen empirical evidence showing that top management asking line managers to reduce employee turnover in their workplaces works. It does reduce quit rate by about a quarter with no explicit incentives there. And the mechanism through which this effect happens, as far as we can see, is through managers spending more time communicating, talking, and advising their subordinates. So these are the three practices we were talking about. Then we said, okay, what happens if turnover is inevitable? The key thing to do when turnover is inevitable is to try to make it as non-disruptive and as inexpensive to the organization as possible. And this has to do with retaining as much knowledge within the organization as possible. So there are various knowledge management strategies that we looked at, such as formalization of job procedures, such as organization of work in teams so that team members could learn from each other and thus spread the knowledge, and creating a knowledge management strategy whereby knowledge is collected and disseminated within the organization. Okay, so that's all I had to say today. There's time for questions. If there are no questions, I'm will be here. But if there are no questions, thanks, and have a good Carnival night.